Welcome to The Inner Circle, the podcast bringing you into honest conversations about climate action. Together, we'll talk to business owners, experts, activists, and others who are working on circular economy initiatives on the ground. We'll uncover what we're doing right, where people are going wrong, and what needs to be done to change the system to value people and the planet. Together, we're making the impossible possible.
Welcome back to The Inner Circle. My name is Erin Andrews. I'm the founder and executive director of Impact Zero, and I'm so happy to have you back with me this week to talk about all things circular economy. So, updates for this week, what's going on at Impact Zero? So, we have our monthly Explore series feature, which is where we talk to professionals who are working in sustainability and circular economy to talk about their experiences, what's working, and what work we still have left to do. So each live fireside chat type discussion brings a unique perspective about sustainability to our community. And our next event will actually be featuring myself. So we are going to be talking about nonprofits because we've been having a lot of conversations with for-profit people and other people who work in corporations and small businesses. But we realize that we haven't really talked so much about the role of nonprofits in society because we believe that nonprofits are a critical part of our society because we influence change by bringing the right people together to make really cool projects and initiatives come to life. So if you're interested in the nonprofit world, if you have a nonprofit, if you're working at a nonprofit, then join us to have this conversation about how we can influence change as people who might not have the biggest budgets or have like the most significant corporate presence. On that note, I do want to shout out to one of our team members. So this week I want to feature Tiana. So Tiana is our email marketing coordinator, and she is basically the person who sends out all of the comms to our community to keep people kind of like in the loop of what's going on. Because Impact Zero in the last, I would say honestly, over a year, we've had a lot of things change and evolve, and we're actually in the process of changing things even more. And Tiana has been like that, one of the people on the team who's been like super, super consistent at making sure that all of our people are kept in the loop, right? So you know, like if you open your latest Impact Zero like email, you'll know what's going on in the organization every single month. So if you want to be part of our community in that way and like keep tabs on what programs we're putting on, what's available for you to stay involved in the circular economy and even, you know, be kept up to date on things like our next accelerator cohort or other opportunities to participate in like innovation programs, then you can join our Impact Zero community by signing up at impactzero.ca/member-signup. And then you'll get those updates straight from Tiana because she is the best. And honestly, the newsletters are always like super, super fun because you can not only hear about what's going on, but we also like to feature some of our other members. So if you sign up and maybe you're working on something really cool, then you can maybe even be featured in the newsletter to spread awareness about the initiative that you're doing that's related to circular economy. So Tiana does great work, and I just wanted to thank her for all the great things she's done for Impact Zero in the last almost year. I feel like she's been here for almost a year. It's been a very long time. But yeah. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is fundraising, of course. So as a nonprofit, we are always trying to raise money to do the work that we do. And if you want to become a monthly donor, we would very much appreciate it. But basically, like if you want to figure out how your money would be used, right now we're in a phase of trying to fund something that we're calling the Innovation Center. And this is basically like the big vision for Impact Zero. So it's always evolving, but the present kind of like concept that we're working towards as our North Star is this physical space downtown. And it would basically be like a space that's as open as a library. So imagine like if you're anyone who's in the area, like you don't need to fob in, you don't need to have a membership, like you can just come to the space And you can participate in our circular programs. So think of Clotho, think of Case and Circular and all these people that we've worked with in our cohorts who have drop bins where you can, you know, not just recycle, but your materials can go back into circulation. The Innovation Center would have a piece of that. So everybody who we've ever worked with to stand up an initiative would be part of this Innovation Center. And it would even be more than that too. I have these kind of ideas of, even hosting like a precious plastic recycling, facility in that space. So if you're not familiar with precious plastic, it's basically like a small scale recycler where you could take an entire, you know, container or box, say, that's full of polypropylene or even like PET. So like if you have a bunch of like empty water bottles, for example, then precious plastic has these like pretty small scale machines that can take a good amount of that plastic. It can be shredded and then it can be extruded into like tubes into to be pelletized. Or you can actually like mold it into new products. So imagine like if you could just bring extra plastic that you have and turn it into something else that you need. Kind of cool. And that's definitely one of the things that I would want to have at this Innovation Center, because like, you know, you can drop your textiles at Clotho, drop your containers at Case, drop your glass with Circular, all to go back into the economy. But then even for the plastic, that's honestly going to be unavoidable for a long time. Like, how can we facilitate and stand up like local recycling capabilities and turn clean, dry plastic back into products? Because it's really so simple. The reason that our recycling systems don't work is because like they're super contaminated, and like the markets and everything, they're at the mercy of like how much they can sell the material for. But like, what if we just repurposed it ourselves? You know what I'm saying? So that's the kind of stuff that we have kind of going on behind the scenes. And I've honestly kept this like under wraps, but I want to get more out there talking more about it, because I want to open this in 2023. Like, we're not sitting around like doing nothing. Like, this is all what's been going on in the background at Impact Zero. So if you want to be part of this vision, and if you want to be, you know, someone who's contributing to this on a monthly basis to help us, you know, get there closer. We're obviously going to have corporate sponsors as well, but even to like kind of honestly like hold us over between now and when we can actually stand that up with our corporate sponsors. If you can become a monthly member and a monthly donor, and contribute to kind of what we're working towards and help us, you know, keep the lights on, as they say, between now and then, I would really appreciate it. I think it'd be really fun. And I would love to, even like, honestly, if you have any questions or if you have someone that you know who could like help us move towards this vision in whatever way, like either in kind or as a sponsor or as just like a human that I should talk to, then definitely, you know, send people my way, or literally like email me. I'm very available. So my email, as always, is just erin@impactzero.ca. But I just wanted to let you in a little bit on what we're doing over there, because it's super fun. So yeah, would appreciate, no pressure, but would love if you would like to contribute to that. And side note, if you actually do want to become a monthly donor, you can do that at impactzero.ca/donate. We'll link everything in the show notes as per usual. Okay. Now that I've gotten past all of my usual promo stuff, let's get into the guest today. So we're going to be chatting with Jonathan Lukacek. He's lived in Osaka, Japan since 2006, and he is running his own bandana brand. It's called One Ear Brand since 2020. He's worked in Japanese apparel for the last 10 years, and formerly from the Chicago suburbs, Jonathan has a deep interest in how things are made in Japan, and we get into this in the episode. It's really awesome to hear him speak about this, and he's very entrenched in the culture and the art of bandana making specifically. So in this episode, we're going to explore how art and fashion and sustainability all intersect within the context of bandana manufacturing. And honestly, this is something that I have like never talked about or really put too much thought into. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned that to John in the conversation, but it's really, really cool how he talks about it. And it's actually a very applicable topic in the in not only like sustainability, but as a circular economy concept, because bandanas are like the OG textile. So highly recommend, you know, listening that to this all the way through to the end. It's a little bit different style of episode that we usually do. I have less of a format and it's just kind of us chatting. So if you have feedback on that, let me know. But yeah, let's just jump into the conversation with John.
This season of The Inner Circle is sponsored by Reverse Logistics Group, or RLG. Live in 80-plus countries with over 30 years of experience, RLG is a tech-enabled organization that offers tailored recycling and circular economy solutions to meet your needs. RLG puts together convenient solutions that will reduce your environmental impact. RLG gets it. Businesses like yours don't always have the time or the resources to spend thinking about environmental compliance and the health of our planet. RLG is a one-stop solution for compliance, returns, and recycling programs across all Canadian provinces and product categories, including batteries, electronics, and packaging. For example, in Ontario, RLG is collaborating with Circular Materials to help brand owners manage their collection and recycling requirements under the new Blue Box regulation. If you're interested in learning more, contact them at canada@rev-log.com or visit them at www.rev-log.com. That's www.rev-log.com.
My name is Jonathan Lukasek. I am based in Japan, and I've lived here for 15 years in Osaka. What I do now is I own and operate a bandana company that our sole product is bandanas, basically. And these are entirely made locally in Japan and done in a way that we try to create the least amount of logistical impact and ecological impact. So I run the business here by myself, but I have an artist who's based in Los Angeles, and she's a Japanese woman named Yurika Shikai, and she draws all of the bandanas by hand first before she turns them into digital works. And then I've started working with a photographer in Detroit, who a really young guy who does all this analog photography for me, and he sources models locally and friends and acquaintances of his, and everything is done remote. I've never met any of these people in person, partially because I started the business right at the beginning of the pandemic and then couldn't travel or leave the country. So there's that. But in addition to that, I support other small independent Japanese brands getting awareness for overseas buyers and the overseas market and that kind of thing. But that's more so just a very, very side small thing. So that's the gist of it.
Yeah. No, that's great. I love that. Like you make the space for that though, too, right? It's really easy to get wrapped up in your own business's goals. So what's like your motivating, what's like the motivation to help other brands as well?
The main motivation is I think the language gap stops almost everybody from interacting and creates a lot of misunderstanding and communication, like errors and that kind of thing between Japan and English speaking world, because there's so few English speaking, like really good English speaking people in the apparel industry in Japan. That said, the apparel industry in Japan is gigantic in terms of the amount of people working in it. And in those people, I think a very small percentage actually speak English very well. So for them, I try to help out as much as possible, especially small brands that don't have any overseas exposure. So I try to help brands like that and brands that I feel like are trying really hard but need support. The motivation is, though, really to get across things that might be confusing in English, but somehow word them and work them to where people understand them, like, so they don't sound so extreme and like so foreign. So The major motivation is to disarm cultural misunderstandings.
That's really important. Actually, I was talking to someone early today about the important side of like connected communities when we talk about like sustainability. Like people people love to be like, oh, sustainability is just about the planet, right? But like, really, it's about people and like the connections that we have as people on this planet, but then also in relation to each other. So I'm curious if you've had like any learnings from that experience, like anything that surprised you as you're kind of navigating the two cultures.
I think the idea of sustainability in Japan is earnest in that they actually do want to stop environmental change. There's a lot of government programs that earnestly try to change the way people are making stuff. That Japan is kind of annoying to an annoying degree about SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, laid up by the UN. They're teaching them in school, these kind of things. So, I mean, it's great. It's amazing. And you know, where there's no controversy here about things that are basic scientific theory, I know, factual theory, you know, there's no discussion about what's true and what's not. So things can get done in that regard. And the science departments here, I think, are really trying to push that we take care of not only Japan, but the rest of the planet and how big of an impact that has. And I think because Japan's non-theistic religion called Shinto is basically like, you know, nature worship in a way. Their basic ethic principles are based around, like, you know, keeping the environment clean and not leaving trash everywhere and respecting that kind of thing. But at the same time, they're contradictory in a way. But I think in earnest, the Japanese people are really trying to push sustainable development goals for one. And then definitely they're trying to make sure Japanese businesses not only develop technologically and financially, but also to having a positive ecological impact. Now, like renewable energy, they're really pushing that. And I'm not sure if you know, but Japan's been non-nuclear since 2011. And it's caused a lot of issues. But I mean, there's a few. Now they're trying to restart the nuclear power plants because they're trying to get rid of coal plants and stop, you know, they've cut off Russian imports of fossil fuels to Japan. So they're really trying to push this sustainable power generation here too. So for me, the really impressive thing here is that I don't think the world in generally focuses on Japan as an, you know, they're economically important. But also at the same time, comparing them to China, they're a smaller country, but in terms of changing to renewables, they're doing a much better job than much of the rest of the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. I believe it was Japan that has really advanced landfill technology as well, in terms of like resiliency and like not leaking everywhere.
I'm not that really aware of it, but I know they do burn trash here as an energy source.
That could be it. I think it was energy capture.
Yeah, they do that, but they really try to get rid of the fossil fuel problem. And then the recycling program here is, I'm not sure if they do any major domestic recycling, but the program here is very strict, rigid. Even all the way to the rural areas, no one's just tossing stuff. I mean, of course, people do illegal dumping, but for the majority, most people, when they're being watched, they're following the rules. So
yeah, I'm curious, like how that then, like that culture of genuinely appreciating nature and the planet, how that translates in even your business, because I know you have sustainability initiatives with your bandana production. So how has that worked operating in this area versus like in the States?
In the States, I'm pretty sure they don't use any technology that we're using. We're using kind of old technology where fabric is actually dyed while it's being printed. I mean, we use silk screens. However, the actual method of applying the color is totally different than the States. We don't use any like bleaches or any sort of like discharge print chemicals, which like takes color out, which is very well known to be hazardous. Also, our bandanas, the bandanas that I produce are printed right next to each other. So when they're cut, there's no waste. They're printed full width. So there's no like scraps. So everything comes out, it comes out as is. And then since I'm doing very small production in a factory that does a multitude of different types of printing, but the printing they do is all done by people, not machines. So there's no carbon emitted, that kind of thing. You know, like the energy cost is much, much lower. Mm-hmm. Our packaging, we use plastic only to protect people from coronavirus, basically. And packaging for me is an issue that is really hard to avoid because most people want things protected, especially something you're going to wear on your neck like this, your face. You probably want it wrapped in something a little bit. I mean, I'd love to do paper, but paper is very expensive. And if the opportunity arose, I would love to switch to paper. But as things are, plastic's the only alternative for me right now.
Yeah. And like, that's a huge misconception though, for I think a lot of like sustainability people, like they're like, oh, why is this packaged in plastic? But if you think of the damage that would happen to the actual products if it wasn't packaged in plastic as well, right? Like in the shipping process, you know, if it's on a container, or like there's leakages or whatever, like you can potentially have tons of product destroyed, which would be a very negative environmental impact. It's like you need to protect what's actually inside too.
Right. When we did talk about packaging, and a lot of people suggested I do paper and all these different things. And I just ended up doing like a simple, you know, recyclable bag. Well, it's from recycled plastic. So there's that. I'm not sure how much it encourages any environmental cause, but I try to do my best in that regard. I can't win every battle, of course, but for me, the product arriving to the customer in the best condition possible is the number one most important thing. And then, of course, like the product itself, a bandana can not only be used as just a bandana, but the range of uses can replace a lot of other products you might have that are made of plastic. And then also, when it gets old and it starts to fall apart, you could use it to patch anything. It's a textile. So as long as you take some type of care of it, it'll come back and take care of you in the end. So for me, like a small bandana is good, but I think a bigger one for me, it covers more bases. It appeals to a wider audience, really.
I'm actually curious because I know that you're like the bandana person. So
it's a weird niche.
No, I love it though, because like I didn't even think of it that way. Like the variety of uses of the product itself, of course, can replace things, but like, I don't know if this would be fun for you, but I think it'd be fun for me, like a brief history of the bandana, you know, like it's such a staple piece. So I'm curious, like why bandanas? Like, what do you love so much about them?
That's a fantastic question. And I'm going to try and answer the best I can without exposing too much information, because I'd love to write a book about it someday. basically let me just say this first. The majority of people think bandana is like an American thing, and they're definitely not. They're most definitely not. And they're way cooler than being like some American Bon Jovi album cover or something like that. actually, their history goes all the way to India. India was one of the first places in the world to have cotton plants and produce woven cotton. And because of the climate, people generally wore bandanas, which were, the word is an Indian word, and it comes from a word that means like tie-dyeing. So they would like resist dye little dots by tying them with thin thread and snip the thread off, dye it, and then remove the thread, and you'd have like, you know, a pattern. And that technique is the original word for bandana. But the word bandana is a Portuguese mispronunciation of the Indian word. That's why you have, like, I spell it with two N's, which is the Portuguese, like, you know, they have that little like curvy Q N in Spanish and Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's accented there, because the original mispronunciation was Portuguese. And then Vasco da Gama went to India, I think, I'm going to screw this date up, 14 something or 16 something. I can't remember which. It's 200 years. There's a huge gap in history. It's really bad of me not to remember. But around that time, he went from Portugal all the way around Africa and ended up in this town called Calico, which interestingly enough is the Western name for bandana fabric, or like this type of feed sack or quilt fabric is called Calico. And all the wording for cotton textile, the thin cotton textiles, all come from the town Calico, where Vasco da Gama first arrived in India. And of course, sailors being sailors and conquistadors being conquistadors, they tried to bring back as much as they could to show, you know, how far behind they were, or how, like, they're looking for stuff they didn't have before. And I'm sure, like, there was a trade route on land through Constantinople, Turkey, that area, and through Eastern Europe, but I don't think textiles made it that far. So the direct route would be by ship. And once they had these, they saw these bright red fabrics that didn't really exist in Europe. Of course, sailors are going to want to wear that as like a badge of honor, right? They want a cool souvenir to take home. And so my theory is, and there's no major documentation, or and no one's really studied this in depth as far as I know, I haven't been to Portugal. I haven't been to the Maritime Museum in Lisbon. But that culture of bandanas being associated with sailors and workwear started there with Vasco da Gama and his group, I'm theorizing. And then they brought that back to Europe. And of course, trade between India and Europe started in mass, right? So we have like spice trade kicking off around that time, textile trade, indigo trade, all sorts of things like that. There's documentation on that. Of course, you can, once they started trading, they started documenting all this. They had to insure it and they had to like basically put, you know, a ship's log of what exactly they were bringing back. And then once it got to Europe and blew up a little bit, then you fast forward to the Industrial Revolution and the East India Trade Company. And once they started colonizing India, they had a lot of people from England living in India. What they did, which is insane if you think about it, it's kind of like what America did after World War II to a lot of countries, that they would sell their own products back to them at a huge cost. And what they would do is they would get Indian cotton from India, send it to the UK, print it, send it back to India, and they'd buy it like twice tariffed and taxed. The rich people from the UK who lived in, who, you know, the colonists of India were paying like extraordinary amounts for the same textile that would have cost them nothing. I have trade labels with all these things on it. And this history is covered in a book written by the University of Scotland in Edinburgh. And that details like all the British Turkey Red printing industry, which was also making bandanas and handkerchiefs during this time. And they were the largest exporter from like basically the 100 years of the 1800s. They basically did that for 100 years. Mm-hmm. America started to import British textiles until like the independence movement. So by 1776, I think in Pennsylvania, there was a guy who's related to Tina Fey, the comedian, her like great, 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 great grandfather who mm-hmm. made a bandana of George Washington. He's from his Graves actually in Philadelphia. That guy started not printing, they were bleached and printed. I think cotton back then was not very clean, so it was probably quite rough. And so when you bleached it would make it pure white. So when you dyed it was a lot easier, a lot more, you could get a consistent product. And so before that, like, so the bleaching technologies basically started in England and then started moving to America, and France and Switzerland had their own bandana factory and industry as well. Not as big as England, but still fairly big. Then, you know, around the early 1800s, as soon as England started their mass export of these dyed and printed textiles, they started shipping them to the States, of course. And during that time, a lot of people from England started moving to the States, especially the people who had this technological background. And a lot of them started establishing these factories. And by the middle 1800s, right before the Civil War, there was quite a few of these factories operating in Rhode Island. And Rhode Island was the major hub for bandanas being manufactured in the U.S. That eventually all ended because of the just, I think, textile, one, Civil War, two, World War One, and what killed it eventually was World War Two. Because the, you know, there was no need for them. And then the nature of people's job and occupation changed over time as well. And little by little, all of these factories, well, their inventory would have moved west with the expansion of America. And so there's documentation of this as well in a lot of different books. You can even look at shipping logs from this era as well, that people were shipping the type of textile that would, they wouldn't mark it as bandana or handkerchief. They would call it something else. They would ship that to the west or all the way around South America and that. And then by 1980, made in America bandanas were pretty much gone because most of the manufacturing in America was third party to China and Asia. And here we are today with making them in Japan. But what really changed is, I think, the nature of people's occupations. For one, I think people spent less time outdoors. Mm-hmm. Also, the invention of air conditioning and that kind of thing, and people driving cars also killed it quite quickly. But I mean, it's always stuck as a fashion thing, but as like, you know, a functional textile, it's gone up and down over the years. But it's little by little, I see it making a comeback now because people are enjoying like outdoor activities like botany and that sort of thing. Sorry for the confusing timeline.
No. It's really interesting though, because the way that like you can explore that colonization movement of materials into the West and then export it, right. Like that happens in so many industries, right? And like, I mean, the negative impacts of colonization obviously are well known, but even to have it highlighted in that aspect, because bandanas are like so popular, and I'm curious like how much of it is being, or how much of them that are sold now are like actually being produced in India, right?
Very few are being exported from India. India's making the textile for it, like silk and that kind of thing, but it's not the quality that they were used to make by any means. Also, the quality of cotton has gone down from India, I think. Mm-hmm. Comparing actual bandanas from like 150 years ago, even 170 years ago, I have some examples, and they're totally different fabrics. But the way they mm-hmm. actually make thread now is done to a much higher spec, and therefore you can make crappy cotton to something much nicer because of technology. So there's that, but we lost a lot of that craftsmanship of hand spinning and hand reeling thread. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually sure. There's definitely people doing these type of, you know, tie-dye textiles in India still, but to what extent, I'm not sure they're making bandanas or like square pieces of fabric. There is a small ethnic group in the Czech Republic or near Hungary too, called Kek Festos. And what they do is they make these large shawl type indigo dyed bandanas and handkerchiefs, but they're mainly used for traditional wear and that type of thing. So it's like a local tourism type souvenir type thing right now, but they still produce them and they're still quite nice quality. Also, Swiss, they don't have any either. There used to be a place near Lausanne. I don't know. It's near one of those lakes that used to have a huge bandana industry as well.
Huh. I never knew that. I used to live in Switzerland, actually. I was there for a couple of years.
Right. If you've seen any like traditional ethnic like festivals where they wear the Edelweiss handkerchiefs, that's what I'm talking about.
Got it. Yes. There's this wild spring festival. It's called Fasnacht. And they have these characters. They're wearing them. That's so interesting. I didn't know that was like a thing that the Swiss used to be.
Apparently they used to produce them. I have a book that like outlines it quite extensively. I've never really seen any like old Swiss made handkerchiefs or bandanas. So I was so surprised to see that. There's very few people collecting that kind of thing as well. So
yeah, because you curated a museum collection, right?
Right.
So what, like, I'm very curious to know, they're so delicate, right? So anything that's, I mean, I feel like they're delicate. I don't know if that's true, but I feel like they'd be hard to preserve over time. What was that process like in collecting them, you know, and curating that exhibit?
They're actually surprisingly resilient. The ones from like 150 years ago are so good quality that you could actually wear them if you wanted to.
Really?
I know a guy, he's this big hunky dude I know who collects old bandanas. He wears them going hiking and stuff. They're like 150 year old pieces. And I'm like, I always trip out because he's wearing them just like, just like where I'm wearing this. But yeah, they're like these really big size ones too. The older ones tend to be really big, and they're always like the full width of the fabric, like the self edge on the sides. And they printed them that way because it was just so much cheaper. But they're not that delicate. In the museum, to get back to your question, in the museum, we had about 400 pieces, maybe 20 to 30 of which were like over 100 years old. I would consider rare and unique. And they ended up being framed, but they kept them out of the sunlight for a while. A few they did put in this one really sunny room, and some of them got sun damaged, which was a big mistake. they had a layout they already wanted to commit to. So, and plus they're just the property of the person who owns the museum. So what we did was, well, what I did for the most part, basically my project and all the information cards and the history and everything, I had spent like months and months researching basically just American made bandanas, but I did trail off a little bit into the origins and how they made their way to America. But the museum has basically the fast color bandanas, which are first dyed either red or blue, and then the color is bleached out like the pattern is bleached out of it. And these were mass produced on cylinder printing machines in tens of thousands very, very rapidly. And then most of these were produced in South Carolina and again, Rhode Island. The major brand of this collection is called Elephant Brand. That's what the name of the museum is called, the Elephant Brand Bandana Museum. And that company used to be based in New York. The same family owns the copyright. However, the company is like kind of a mix. It's called the New York Fashion Company or something like that. They own like a few different brands, but one of their main things is the elephant. They own the rights to the elephant brand because the great-great-granddaughter of the original owner still works there.
Oh, wow.
And they were telling me for their archives and research, they don't really have any archives, nothing that's that old, maybe to the 1960s at the most. I met with them a few years ago, and I was telling them about their company, so.
Oh, my gosh. That's so funny.
And so that company was basically selling those handkerchiefs and bandanas by mail order and like through wholesale and that kind of thing. But they were all produced in Rhode Island and North Carolina for the most part. Like the fabric was made in North Carolina and then printed in Rhode Island. The museum basically features that brand. That's just the one I want to say.
Over time, the production, obviously the stint in the States was brief in comparison to the rest of the world. But I'm curious, like if the technological development while production was happening in the States was like a positive or a negative contributor in terms of like the sustainability of the production? Because I imagine the original production was quite like, you know, small batch, no waste kind of thing, but the States is not exactly the same,
right?
You know, don't have the same mindset. So I'm curious what that did to the product and the sustainability of it.
The funny thing is I find with most made, one easy way to tell a made in USA bandana, even if it doesn't say made in USA, even if it might be from the same era as one that's made in the UK, the print quality is so vastly different. And the fabric sometimes like at an angle, it's the print's not squared on there. It's sometimes shifted to the left and right. But that doesn't mean it's bad quality. It just means they didn't throw anything away. And even like my production, they can't be perfect because it's all hand printed and sewn by one guy. And so when they cut the top and bottom and they sew it, sometimes it gets crooked just because the fabric is selvedge. And selvedge fabric is a weird way of when you wash it, it's kind of unpredictable in a way, unless it's been the yarn's been treated with like a million different chemicals. And I try to avoid that because I prefer that like kind of that authentic type of unpredictability of it. But as far as technology of bandana printing in America, I think the ones from 150 years ago during the Industrial Revolution were far, far superior in quality because they were not discharge printed. Because discharge printing is such a mass production style of printing, because you're using these really huge rollers and they print like four at a time, the length of the fabric, and there's two on each side. So only one side of the bandana has like a bordered by the edge of the fabric. So after that, they have to cut it out and then sew three sides. And so for me, that's a low quality bandana because of the way it's produced. And the more stitches it has, the more sides are stitched, the less quality you get, because the shape of the bandana is really weird, because you'll get them when the sides that are sewn are totally like off the justification. So they'll be like the margins are so way off, and the consistency is okay because you're talking like thousands and thousands of units being printed and then sold very cheaply. But the overall quality is so bad. I mean, they're collectible to some degree, but they're not like, I wouldn't put them in a gallery for a historic, like I wouldn't have them in the Smithsonian if it was my choice. Just I would put them in there for their impact on in industrial, you know, manufacturing, but I wouldn't put them there for their designs.
Yeah, they don't get like the best spot.
No, not at all. It's funny because like the major bandana that was used, like, so, you know, like I think the Western world, the t-shirt is like the main political textile for most people. Is that your image as well?
I mean, probably I would say so.
The funny thing is the bandana was way, way earlier politically used as a marker for politics than the t-shirt, because t-shirt didn't like really evolve to what we have today. It was just underwear. It didn't really work as a political thing until like the 50s or 60s.
Right.
And the first political use of the bandana was like the Andrew Jackson election of 1828. That's the first time the bandana was mass produced for a presidential campaign, and it has had his face on it. From then until Teddy Roosevelt, every presidential candidate tried to make a campaign bandana.
Interesting.
Some of them had political slogans, some had colors, because back in this era, Republicans were blue and Democrats were red. And or the Republicans were red always, but their views were totally different than they are today. And it's funny to see like these really atrocious politicians with like blue bandanas and these other ones with red bandanas. But I think because the cost of production on blue was so huge that there was very few blue political bandanas made. Most of them were red, regardless of political party. So
interesting. It's almost like a flag, right? Like the flags symbolize bringing communities together. It's kind of like a personal flag that you can literally just wear.
Right. It's sort of like when people have like ribbons to support a cause or or like a MAGA hat or, you know, anything like that. This is way before. Sometimes even like special men's clubs or secret societies had used handkerchiefs where they put them in their pocket in a different way. That's how they knew they were a member on the street, you know, like tip their hat kind of thing. Like that they had that a lot of that kind of thing. Some people would wear a brooch, you know, like a brooch that no one would know, or like a pin. Even in Japanese politicians often wear government pins now to know that they're like a government official.
Hmm. We need to make bandanas for like the environmental movement, you know?
Yeah.
Something on the DL. Oh, man.
That's where I want to go to next, actually.
Oh, really? This is a great segue.
Did I answer your question, though?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just going with it. I forget what my question was at this point.
I just want to make sure I answered it. But yeah, the bandanas made by the Elephant Brand Company were, I think, iconic in the sense that most people think of bandanas, they think of those. The colors are red or blue, and they're distinctively white patterns. And I think, I mean, those are cool, but I've kind of matured past them in an art sense, because they're only, it's like kind of like a black and white photograph. I mean, they're cool looking, but they don't express, there's way other ways to express it. You know what I mean? Sometimes more color is the right way.
Yeah.
The apparel world right now is kind of getting to a point where a lot of people are wearing just monotone color palettes. And like, I think a bandana can, if you put one on or you use it in a certain way, it becomes so much, it adds so much to something so simple. So I don't really want to change people's style. I just want to add something to it, you know, or not to add a political side to it, just a spice of design. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah. And it's like literally like a blank canvas, right? Like you could do like anything with it. And I'm guilty. I'm one of those people. I mean, like I'm wearing like a black shirt, but I think it is like a nice way to have like a personal touch to express whatever it is you want to, whether it's political or, you know, just anything else that is important or that you want to get out, but to have like a, artistic like depth as well, compared to just like a black and white, like a binary design, essentially. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. If you were colorblind, it would just look black and white anyway, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But I'm curious to hear, like, what are you working on then when we were talking about the environmental? Oh. I'm curious to hear, like, what you're thinking of for that.
Lately, like, I've really been into botany for, like, the last year or so. I've been kind of self-studying botany and going down a wormhole of botany. Basically started just walking around the neighborhood, like, what the hell plants are these, you know? And like I started getting plants from my mother-in-law, and I started taking care of plants. My kids are older now, so I'm getting to the point where I start looking for hobbies. And I have all, like, my mother-in-law gives me all these plants all the time that she grows. And so I started looking at old books that I have, like, I don't know if you remember these from when you were a kid, these little tiny, the golden guide books, and the illustrations are kind of amazing. And I always just like, I use these as like, not only my color palette for a lot of my bandanas, but also the designs come from plants as well. And I really came upon this idea where I would love to produce more bandanas featuring rare plants that are maybe being poached, or people are buying them for their house and instead of doing that, why not make bandanas instead of taking a living thing and putting your house in this lit, slowly torturing it to death? Why not just wear one that's a sketch of one?
Yeah, it would actually be really interesting, like, yeah, to raise awareness even about species that are disappearing. But it makes me think, I have a friend who actually, she'll have an episode on the podcast as well. And she's Indigenous. She lives like north of Toronto. But, you know, there's literally food supplies that are being threatened due to climate change. So like all the different aspects of like, whether it's human, you know, meddling or even just like climate, we're going to lose species of plants for sure. That could be really cool.
Yeah. It's such a something that's not being discussed, like, relatively. I mean, it's going to happen, which is a sad thing, because the more people like grow like lawns and like invasive species in their yards, the less native species have a chance to, you know, have less space. And there's a podcast I've been listening to. He's a really cool guy. He's from Chicago. But he's constantly talking about how people, just pro ecology people, you know, the environmentally conscious people, and at the same time they're totally killing the botany around them, all the plants and the native wildlife around them, inconsequently because of their lifestyle and, you know, a living situation or living choices. But so like I have a bandana that we did, like a psilocybin mushroom one, which is the one I'm wearing right now. We did like a cactus one with features like a peyote design, and I did another one with a moth, which is a moth from the East Coast of America, the rosy maple moth, which I always thought was like a really cool, strange, it's really adorable freaking thing. It's like the cutest thing ever. But I try to focus on nature because I think nature is already like kind of like the most fashionable place. I mean, you don't have to like really invent anything here. You can just look at nature closely and you'll find things that you wouldn't need to like copy another designer or copy a fashion movement. You can just find it sitting there in nature without having to kill it or cut it down.
Yeah, we can just appreciate it.
For me, like, I think a lot of designers do poach so many things where they inadvertently create a desire for things that have a negative impact. The lily population of people around the entire world has exploded because of Hermes scarves. That kind of thing. I don't know how much of an impact that. I don't think very many people look at how design negatively impacts people's habits, but I'm sure if there was research done, or if, I mean, just like empirical observation, I see it happen. People like start collecting cactus because people make cactus bowls, like designer cactus bowls, and they're like, they live in like New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, I that kind of stuff, like anything that becomes industrialized, you know, and that's not native to where you are, it's worth questioning the environmental impact, because it's coming from somewhere and it's got to get to you, and all the resources that go into that just to maintain it, and then, yeah, eventually possibly just kill it. It's worth questioning. But I do think that like bandana idea is really, it's really cool to have, like, you know, the purpose behind it. And that's where the art can come into it. Like, I think art and movements are like connected, obviously. And it can be like a really powerful force, for, it's like the best marketing, right?
It's like organic marketing, really. If you go to like an art gallery and see a piece of art you like, you're not gonna like, can't throw it up on social media and be like, hey, look, I love this art so much, it's me, and like that kind of thing. But, you know, if you go to an art museum, it's kind of like a personal, you find something personal about it, you know. And I really want bandanas to be like that, where they become like a personal accessory, and they are very personal. That's why I try to make designs and colors that are more like vibrant and natural and unnatural at the same time, that appeal to people's like irrational sense of beauty.
Yeah, no, that's all really fascinating. And honestly, like, this is something that I've like never honestly put much thought into, because it's just never been something that's on my radar. But it's really cool to hear like the depth of what this is, and like what, you know, something as simple as a bandana can be, right? So yeah, I want to know, like, is there anything that if people wanted to learn more about what you're working on, or if, like, how can people support you the best way right now?
By going to the website and buying bandanas from me or from any of the stores, sharing photos of you wearing them, or sharing photos of other people wearing them. For me, seeing the product out in the wild is the best thing. But also, if you have ideas for things that you'd love to see as a bandana, I always kind of gauge people's opinions and definitely take that as creative input. So that also helps too. Yeah, but like for me, the sales of product directly impacts my life. So it's always a huge support.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, for me, even like I sometimes feel weird being like, become a donor for Impact Zero, you know, but like you need to be able to continue to do the work to expand the impact of it. Right. Like we can't make big impacts staying small. So,
yeah, I always like to say I'm a sole operator and my profits go to working on designs and helping fund my life and my work. I use public transportation. I live a very small, try to live the smallest impact life I can. That type of support definitely helps creating more work for me and moving projects forward. So I don't have like a team of 20 people I work with. I work basically by myself and my artists.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's great, right? I mean, even if you had a huge team, still great. We still need people to work on this stuff. So
right.
Yeah, it's really great to hear your perspective. And I know your time is valuable. So I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of The Inner Circle. If you'd like to learn more about the foundation, you can visit our website at impactzero.ca. You can also find us on Instagram at impactzero.ca and as well on LinkedIn, Impact Zero Foundation. Thanks again for hanging out with us today, and we'll see you next week.